Chapter 11. A Cross and a Star. The moon rose slowly between two bars of dark clouds, which beneath her shining presence gradually whitened to silver. Then a scintillating, diamond-like pathway of light began to spread itself reflectively over the sea. I remained at the window, strangely disinclined to turn back into the darkness of my room. Gradually, I began to think that perhaps it was a little hard that I should have been left all by myself, locked up thus in this little room. Surely I might have been allowed a light of some sort. Then I reproached myself for allowing the merest suggestion of a complaint to enter my mind. After all, I was here in the house of Aselsion as an uninvited guest. I was not wanted. And I remembered the order that had been issued concerning me. The moment she desires to leave, every facility for her departure is to be granted to her. I was much more afraid of this facility for departure than I was of my present solitude. I therefore determined to view the whole adventure in a cheerful light, stifling though I was now finding the atmosphere. If it was good for me to be alone, then loneliness was what I too wanted. If it was necessary for me to be in darkness, then darkness was agreeable also to me. Scarcely had I thus made up my mind to accept these conditions, than my room suddenly became illumined with a soft yet effulgent radiance. I started up in amazement. From whence had this light come? By what strange cause had it appeared, just when I decided to accept the darkness? It seemed a conscious response to my thoughts. Nowhere could I see any lamp. It was as though the walls themselves glowed with a surface luminance. After my first surprise had passed, I was charmed and delighted by the warm, comforting brightness around me. It reminded me somewhat of the electric brilliancy on the sails of the Dream. I moved away from the window, leaving it open, for the night was close and warm, and sat down at the table to read a little. After a few minutes, however, I laid my book aside to listen to a strange whispering music that floated towards me, apparently from the sea, thrilling me to the soul. No eloquent description could convey an idea of the enthralling sweetness of those harmonies. They were more breathed than sounded upon the air. I became absorbed in following the rhythm of the delicate cadences as they rose and fell. By degrees, my thoughts wandered to Rafael Santoris. Where was he now? In what peaceful expanse of shining waters had his fairy vessel cast its anchor? I pictured him until I could almost see his face, the broad brow, the fearless eyes, the tender smile, and I fancied that I heard the deep, soft accents of his voice. Always when he spoke to me, so gentle. And a quick wave of tenderness rose in my heart. My whole soul rushed as if with outstretched arms to greet him. I knew in my heart that he was more to me than all the world, and aloud I said to him, "My beloved, I love you, I love you," as if to convey the thought to him who of all people in this world was to me the most dear. Then I scolded myself. How foolish and futile it was to speak thus into the empty air. At last I wearied of much thinking to no purpose. Closing the window then, I undressed and went to bed. As I lay there, the light in my room, to my amazement, was suddenly extinguished, and everything around me was darkness again, except for the moon, sending a clear white ray straight through the lattice, for there was no curtain to shut out the light. For some time I remained awake on my hard little couch, watching this moon ray, and steadily refusing to allow any thought of fear or loneliness to enter my mind. The music which had so enchanted me ceased. All around me reigned perfect stillness. My eyes closed by and by, my tired limbs relaxed, and I fell into a sound and dreamless sleep. When I awoke, it was full morning, and sunlight shone upon the sea. I sprang up, full of delight at having slept so peacefully, and relieved that nothing strange or terrifying had occurred. I do not know why I should have anticipated anything untoward, except for Aselzion's words to me about expecting martyrdom. Everything in the brightness of the new day seemed wonderfully fresh and beautiful. The very simplicity of my room held a greater delight than I could have found in the most luxurious hotel bedroom. The only unusual thing I noticed was that the soft, cold water with which my bath was supplied sparkled this morning, as though it were effervescent. Once or twice it seemed to ripple with a crystalline foam, and in fact, I observed that the water was never actually still. I watched its glittering movement for some minutes before stepping into the bath. Then, feeling reassured that it was charged with some kind of electricity, I plunged in without hesitation and reveled in the delicious sense of invigoration the water gave me. When my toilet was complete, and I had attired myself in a simple morning gown of white linen, more suitable to the warm weather than the black one I had traveled in, I went and threw open my window to let in all the freshness of the sea air. I was surprised to see a small, low door open in the side of the turret. Through it, I discovered a winding stair leading downward. Yielding to impulse, I descended it, and at the end found myself in an exquisite little rock garden abutting the seashore. I could actually open a gate and walk to the very edge of the sea, so then I was not a prisoner. If I so chose, I could even run away. I looked about me, then smiled as I saw the impossibility of any escape. The little garden belonged to the turret exclusively. On each side of it towered impassable rocks, almost to the height of the Chateau d'Aselzion itself, while the bit of shore on which I stood was hemmed in equally by huge boulders against which, for centuries, the waves had dashed themselves without making the slightest impression. Yet, it was delightful to feel I was allowed this little bit of freedom in the open air, and I remained there for several minutes, watching the sea and delighting in the warmth of the southern sun. After some time, I slowly retraced my steps, looking about me as I went to see if there was anyone nearby. Not a soul was in sight. I returned to my room to find my bed made as neatly as though it had never been slept in. My breakfast, consisting of a cup of milk and some wheaten biscuits, had been set on the table. I was quite ready for the meal and enjoyed it thoroughly. When I had finished, I took my empty cup and plate and put them on the dresser in the niche. Thereupon, instantly, the dresser was lowered and as quickly disappeared. I began to wonder now how I should employ my time. There was no point in writing letters, though I had my own traveling desk ready for this purpose. I did not wish my friends or acquaintances to know where I was. Even had I written to a few of them, it was hardly likely that any letter would ever reach them, for I felt sure the mystic brotherhood of Aselzion, so long as I remained with them, would not allow me to communicate with the outside world. I sat meditating and began to consider that if I passed several days aimlessly in this way, they would become difficult to bear. My watch had stopped, so I could not keep count of the time, and there was no clock or chime of any sort that I could hear. The stillness around me would have been oppressive had it not been for the soft dash of little waves as they broke upon the beach below my window. All of a sudden, to my relief, the door of my room opened, and the man called Honorius entered. He bent his head slightly by way of salutation and said briefly, "You are commanded to follow me." I rose obediently and stood ready. He looked at me intently, with curiosity, as though seeking to read my mind. Remembering that Aselzion had said I was not to speak unless spoken to, I only returned his look steadfastly, with a smile. "You are not unhappy? Not afraid? Not restless?" he said slowly. "That is well. You have made a good beginning. And now, no matter what you see or hear, keep silent. If you desire to speak, speak now. But after we leave this room, not a word may escape your lips, not a single exclamation. Your business now is to listen, learn, and obey." He waited, giving me the opportunity to reply, but I preferred to hold my peace. He then handed me a folded length of soft white material, opaque, yet fine and silky as gossamer. "Cover yourself with this veil," he said, "and do not lift it until after you return to this room." I unfolded the veil and threw it over me quickly, draping my body from head to foot. It was as delicate as a feather, and though I myself could see through it perfectly, it concealed me effectively from the gaze of others. Honorius then signed for me to follow, and I did so, my heart beating quickly with expectation. We went through passages with intricate turnings from which there seemed no outlet. It was like threading one's way through a maze. At last I found myself enclosed within a small cell-like area. There was an opening before me, through which I gazed upon a strange and picturesque scene. It was the interior of a small but perfectly designed and constructed Gothic chapel, lit by numerous windows of stained glass. Through this glass, the sunlight filtered in streams of radiant color, patterned with gold, crimson, and blue. The flooring beneath was white marble. Between the tapered columns supporting the finely carved roof on either side of the chapel were two rows of benches. Here sat an array of motionless white figures, men in the garb of their mysterious order, their faces almost wholly concealed by drooping cowls. There was no altar in the chapel, but at its eastern end, where an altar might have been, hung a dark purple curtain, against which blazed in brilliant luminance a cross and seven-pointed star. The rays of light shed by this uplifted symbol of an unwritten creed were so vivid as to be almost blinding, and nearly eclipsed the summer glory of the sun itself. Awed by the reverent solemnity of my surroundings, I was glad to be hidden behind the folds of my enshrouding veil. Though I realized that I was hidden in any case, in a secret recess made purposely for the use of anyone who was summoned to see without being seen what went on in the chapel. I waited, full of eager anticipation. Presently the low, vibrant sound of the organ began to tremble on the air, gradually increasing in power and volume, until, like a sunbeam breaking through the clouds, a magnificent anthem poured from it. I drew a long breath of pure ecstasy. I could have wept tears of gratitude for the mere sense of hearing. The music was divine. The idea of mortality was swallowed up in it and destroyed. As my own imprisoned soul mounted up, rejoicing on wings of light to great heights of life. When the music ceased, as it did all too soon, there ensued a profound silence, so profound that I could hear the quick beating of my own heart, as though the very center of my life were here in this place. I turned my eyes toward the dazzling cross and star, from which issued ever-darting rays of fiery brilliance, and the effect of its lambent brilliance was as if an electric current were sending forth messages which no mortal skill could ever decipher or put into words, but which penetrated to the deepest levels of one's awareness. All at once I noticed a slight movement among the rows of white-garmented, white-cowled figures that had hitherto been sitting motionless. And with one accord they all rose to their feet, while a figure, stately and imposing, came walking slowly the length of the chapel and stood directly in front of the flaming symbol, holding both hands outstretched as though to invoke a blessing. It was the Master Aselzion himself, invested with a dignity and splendor that seemed impossible to man. He might at that moment have been no mortal, but a divine angel. His aspect was one of absolute power and absolute poise. Other men might entertain doubts of themselves and of their purpose in life, but this man expressed by his mere bearing an air of complete self-assurance, strength, and divine authority. He wore his cowl thrown back, and from where I sat in my secluded corner, I could see his features distinctly. I could watch the flash of his fine, steadfast eyes as he turned them upon his followers. Keeping his hands extended, he declared in a firm, clear voice, "To the Creator of all things visible and invisible, let us offer up gratitude and praise, and so begin this day." A responsive murmur of voices answered him. "We praise thee, O divine power of life and love eternal. We praise thee for all we are. We praise thee for all we have been. We praise thee for all we hope to become. Amen." There followed a moment's silence. Then the assembled brethren sat down in their places, and Aselzion spoke in distinct, measured accents, with the easy and assured manner of one who has experienced the truths he preaches. "Friends and brethren, we are gathered together here to look back upon our lives and consider what we have done in the past and what we are preparing for the future. We know that from the past, stretching back to infinity, we have made this our own present. We know also that, according to divine law, what we do from now on will determine what we become in future, which again stretches forward to eternity. We shall evolve from now on out of the seeds we are planting today. All of us make our own destiny. Shall it be a growth in love and in devotion? Will it be mere intellectual analysis? Will it be doubt and rejection? There is no gain in understanding life only with our minds. We must absorb the truth with all of our being, with our hearts above all, but also with mental clarity, without prejudgment, and with a positive, welcoming attitude of mind. I am not here to teach you spiritual mathematics, for these would never uplift your hearts. I am here to speak to you of the power of love, divine love. You are not here merely to think about God. You are here to experience Him in your hearts. The beliefs taught in churches have no value unless their adherents experience the truths they proclaim. Remember this too. You are not separate or different from God. He dreamed you into existence. It is your decision whether you want to become enmeshed in and enjoy the dream, or whether you want to escape the dream by merging back into His love and bliss. If you choose to enjoy the dream, you will have to accept that you have also chosen endless suffering. Oh yes, in this realm of duality you will also find success, pleasure, and outer happiness. But these fulfillments will always come with a price. You will have to accept also their opposites, failure, misery, and an awareness of having accomplished nothing real or valid. Seek God, therefore. He is your only answer. Whichever direction you turn, there are forces greater than you that will pull you, with more than your own power, toward themselves. As Akela said in Kipling's Jungle Book, choose well, O wolves. As he spoke thus, I, looking out from my little hidden recess, saw a movement among the seated brethren. One of them rose and, descending from his place, walked slowly towards Aselzion until he was within a few paces of him. There he paused and threw back his cowl, showing a worn, handsome face, struggling to reach enlightenment. Master, I try daily, as is our routine, to offer myself to God in meditation, but often it seems to me that he doesn't even listen. Does God really care about us human beings? Does God care? Of course he cares, my child. You are his own self. We've discussed this before, William. Remember, I told you, your problem in past lives was spiritual doubt. That doesn't mean God holds your past skepticism against you, but it has left a subconscious block to your own progress, a tendency to cancel every forward step with a backward thought. Your first job here is to strengthen your forward impetus and to cancel the backward one. The best cure for your particular disease is selfless devotion and love. The more you love God, the more weakened the canceling energy will become, until all your energy moves in one direction only. But, Master, I have worked hard at loving God. Love just doesn't seem to come. Remember, William, there are two positive forces in this struggle of yours. Your own energy, and also God's. He is at the heart of everyone's efforts to reach him. Pray to him for the grace of divine devotion. Chant to him for many hours a day. Concentrate in your heart, and consciously offer the energy there up to him. Thank you, Master. I will keep trying. The man sat down. Another one stood up and came forward. Master, this one said, worldly desires, try as I will to fight them, keep entering my mind. What am I to do about them? I have talents that the world appreciates, a gift for moving people with music. Is it right, I sometimes wonder, to suppress this gift? David, can you not offer your gift up to God? He himself created beautiful music. It doesn't help to suppress your nature. You'll never be able to do it. You can, however, develop it by trying to offer the world music that will inspire people to seek God, and not only music that will entertain. Think of your time here as an apprenticeship in learning how to use your gift as a mission, eventually to bring others to God. God doesn't want us to come to him only for our own salvation. He wants us to be instruments for the salvation of others also. He doesn't appreciate selfishness. He wants us to share his love with all. Thank you, Master. The man sat down. A third presently stood and came forward. Master, he said, I know that this is a wrong thought, but every time I think of all the suffering in the world, I find it difficult not to blame God for it. Why does he allow widows to be mistreated? Why does he allow babies to be born deformed? Why does he allow war and cruelty and hatred? Henry, my child, these apparent injustices become blatantly obvious to everyone as the heart grows in sensitivity. But I call the injustices apparent because, in fact, the law is always just. No one who has ever found God has ever cried, "What a scam! God was wrong to do it all. God is cruel." Always, in every country, throughout history, in every religion and in every culture, those who have attained his consciousness are men and women whom we ourselves would judge to be full of love and compassion. yet they too declare universally, "My long efforts have proved infinitely worthwhile. God is perfect love. God is perfect bliss." It is people who are steeped in the delusion of eco-consciousness who are selfish, who want from others whatever they can get for themselves, instead of wanting to bring happiness to all. It is such people who doubt God's intentions. They want only for themselves. They project their ego-centered desires onto the world. If only one or two people who found God had shown enthusiasm for his show, and only one or two egotists had shown disapproval of it, including its fulfillments and pleasures, one might draw very different conclusions. But these attitudes in both groups are universal. So let us try another tack of reasoning. When God brought the universe into manifestation, for all things are part of his consciousness, nothing can exist apart from him, there was nothing out of which he could manifest anything at all. He had to create the universe by manifesting duality. God is one. To bring anything into apparent existence, he had to make a part of his consciousness, the surface, so to speak, where the waves appear, to be two. The manifestation of light had to be offset by the opposite manifestation of darkness. The manifestation of emotional love, "I want you," rather than simply divine bliss in motion, required the opposite of that love, that is to say, rejection, which in more extreme forms becomes hatred. Unkindness had to be offset by repulsion, even by cruelty. Pleasure had to be offset by its opposite, pain, and so on. Every outward condition is, and cannot but be, offset by its opposite. The further one is removed from God's calm inner consciousness, the more extreme these opposites become. Our actions cannot but come back to us sooner or later. If we have treated others badly, then we shall have, if not in this life, then in another, to be treated badly ourselves. An innocent-seeming baby comes bearing with it the weight of countless debts, as well as the boon of blessings. The only possible solution to the problem of human suffering is to come closer to the oneness of God's bliss and to inspire others to do likewise. The saints, even though God sends them great suffering to prove their love for him, remain ever cheerful, ever even-minded. Nothing can touch them, for they live inwardly at their own center, where opposites cease to exist. "Thank you, Master," the disciple said, and returned to his seat. A fourth rose and came forward. "Master, you've spoken occasionally about soulmates. Is it necessary for everybody to have one?" Aselzion answered, "Well, Brian, that's an interesting question to ask in a monastery. But it isn't really a question of whether we need a soulmate or not. That is to say, it isn't so much a need as a fact. Everything in nature has its dual. From this fact, it becomes obvious that every human being also must have a soulmate. That dual to oneself may even be living on another planet. There is a greater likelihood, however, that they both live on the same planet, and that both have been bumping together constantly on their mutual journey toward God. Your soulmate may be your mother, your sister, your father, or your brother. He or she may even be your best friend. It may quite easily sometimes have been a relationship of mutual hatred, for likes can repel as well as attract. If, for example, both compete in the same business, a soulmate relationship, in order to lead to God, cannot be sexual, for in sexuality there is selfish need, and with your soulmate, the sharing must be completely selfless, not that of ego to ego, in other words, but of soul to soul. A soulmate, then, need not be a mate in the usual sense at all. You needn't worry about it, though. You know the words, "Seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you." This truth applies to one's soulmate also. When God so wills it, your soulmate will be drawn to you. There ensued a few minutes' pause. Then Aselzion said, "If there are no more questions today, I ask for the usual sign." The brethren all rose and raised their arms above their heads, after a second's pause, dropping them slowly again. "Enough." Aselzion now moved towards the cross and star, confronting it fully. As he did so, I saw to my astonishment and even terror that the rays proceeding from the center of the symbol flamed out suddenly to an extraordinary length, surrounding his whole figure and filling the chapel with brilliancy, as though setting his figure suddenly on fire. He advanced steadily straight into the center of the glowing flames. Then, at a certain point, he turned again and faced his followers. But what an aspect was his now! The light about him seemed a part of his very body and clothing. He was transfigured into the semblance of something godlike, angelic. And as I looked upon him, I was overcome with awe. Lifting his right hand, he made the sign of the cross, whereupon the white-robed brethren descended from their places and, walking one by one in line, came up to him where he stood. He spoke, and his voice rang out like a silver clarion. "O divine light," he exclaimed, "we are part of thee, and into thee we pray to become absorbed. From thee we know we may obtain immortality. O nature, beloved mother, whose bosom burns with the hidden fire of creation, we are thy children, born of thee in spirit more than in matter. In us thou hast distilled thy rains, dews, snows, and frost, thy sunlight and thy storms. In us thou hast embodied thy prolific beauty, thy productiveness, thy power to advance toward the good. Thou hast endowed us above all with the capacity for divine love, which draws us to thee and draws to us all good in return. Receive us, O cosmic light, thou, O supreme spirit of love. Guide us always to manifest the highest good. Amen." Once more the glorious organ music surged like a mighty ocean wave through the chapel, and I knelt, trembling in every limb, covering my veiled face closely with my hands. I was overcome by the splendor of the sound and the strangeness of the scene. Gradually, very gradually, the music died away, and a deep silence followed. When I raised my head, the chapel was empty. Aselzion and his disciples had vanished noiselessly. It was as if the chapel had been empty always. Only the cross and the star remained there, glittering against the dark purple background and darting out long rays of pale violet, crimson, and other delicate hues of pink topaz. I looked around me, then behind. There, to my surprise, I saw that the door of my little recess had been left unlocked and open. Acting on an impulse too strong to resist, I stole softly out, and then, stepping on the tips of my toes and hardly daring to breathe, I found my way through a low archway into the chapel itself. There I remained standing, all alone, my heart beating loudly with terror. Yet what had I to fear? There was no one nearby that I could see, even though it seemed to me that thousands of eyes were watching me from the roof, from behind the columns, from the stained glass windows through which light filtered from the sun onto the marble pavement. The glowing radiance in all that stillness of the cross and star was almost terrible. Its long, bright rays were like tongues of fire, mutely expressive of what? Fascinated, I drew nearer and nearer, then paused abruptly, checked by a kind of vibration beneath me, as if the ground itself were rocking. Presently I gained fresh courage to go on, and by degrees was drawn into a perfect vortex of light, rushing upon me in great waves from all sides. The onrush was so forcible I hardly was aware of my own movements. Like a creature in a dream, I moved, and my hands, as I stretched them out toward that marvelous symbol, looked almost transparent. When my eyes glanced for a moment at the folds of my veil, I saw that its white silkiness was shining with the pale amethystine hue. On and on I went, fired by a desperate desire to go as far as I could into the strange starry center of that living luminance. The very boldness of my intent appalled me, even as I encouraged it. Step by step, I resolutely advanced, until I suddenly felt myself as if caught in a wheel of fire. Round and round me the wheel turned, darting points of whirling radiance as sharp as spears. They seemed to enter my body and stab it through and through. I struggled for breath and tried to draw back. It was impossible. I had become caught in a net of endless light vibrations, which, though emitting no heat, yet quivered throughout my being with a searching intensity, seemingly bent on probing to the very center of my soul. I could not utter a sound, but stood there dumb, immovable, and shrouded in a million colored flames, too stunned with the shock even to recall my own identity. Then, all at once, something dark and cool floated over me, like the shadow of a passing cloud. I looked up and strove to utter a cry, a word of appeal, then fell senseless to the ground.